In May of 1940, World War II was going on for almost a year by this point. And even though this was about a year and a half before the United States would enter the war after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, British and French armies were already fighting to hold off the German invasion. In northern France, the Germans had pushed the Allied army up against the sea, up against the North Sea, part of the Atlantic Ocean, kind of the area between France and England, the English Channel there. They were 20 miles outside of the town of Dunkirk. But they had stopped their advance because they had overrun their supply lines. They didn't want to risk going further because they couldn't get resupplied. So they had over 330,000 British and French soldiers pinned up against the water of the North Sea. British generals were saying that only a miracle could save the struggling forces, because there's no hope of escape. I mean, you had the sea on one side, no hope of escape there, and you have the Germans on the other. This actually became a major turning point in the war, because most of the British land force was included in that 330,000. And if they had gotten lost, killed, captured, whatever the case, it's very likely Germany would have been able to invade England, and maybe the United States wouldn't have entered the war. So very important turning point in the war. May 26th was declared a national day of prayer by King Henry VI, and a call went out for as many naval boats as possible, or any other ship capable of carrying 1,000 men, to help an evacuation of these men, to go there and try to help them get off. Many large British and French destroyers responded to the call, but due to their size, they could only go within a mile of the shore. And also, these big destroyers, these big ships, made easy targets for the German planes. So, definitely not easy there. A word of warning, there is a movie coming out on this next month. And so, if you don't want to know what's going to happen in the movie, if you go to see the movie, here's your spoiler alert. But I didn't know the story, but it's an historical story. So it's definitely nothing new. But if you don't want to know what happens, cover your ears for a bit. The situation did not look good for the Allied forces at all. Basically, with this evacuation plan, they had hoped, from what I read, to get about 35 to 50,000 men out. That was what they were hoping for with the situation as it was. But then, unexpectedly, the weather changed. Towering clouds formed and moved in upon the German airships, and then storms began. The rain was so heavy that the German planes were largely grounded. Only very few were able to take off and attack the Allies. And then a dense and heavy fog moved in as well. A fog so dense that the German ground force, they chose not to advance against the Allies because they couldn't see what was ahead of them. And in war, that's probably not a good idea to advance. You don't, especially when you have a desperate enemy pinned up against who knows what they're capable of. So they chose, okay, let's wait the storm out, let's wait this fog out, and then we'll take care of them. But it didn't. That didn't happen. So on the German side, there's fog over on the German side. Meanwhile, for the soldiers who were being evacuated from the beaches, 330,000 people, men, waiting on these beaches, the weather was perfect. Clear skies. As bad a weather as it was on the German side, it was that perfect for the Allies. The weather was suited perfectly for evacuation, while at the same time it hindered the German military. Even the normally turbulent sea of the English Channel was unusually calm. Eyewitnesses would later describe the water as glassy calm or smooth as a mill pond. Since those large ships weren't able to get any closer to within a mile of the shore, another call went out, asking for the owners of a ship of any size to now come over and start taking people from the shores of Dunkirk, either back to England or back to the large ships who could carry them. Ordinary citizens, commercial mariners by the hundreds, moved in close to those beaches and picked up tens of thousands of men in order to transport them again, either directly to England, which was only about 20 to 30 miles away, or to those larger ships. From May 26th to June 4th, the soldiers sought cover on the beaches while they were being bombed. So there were still airplanes flying around, and they were still getting bombed. Not as many as there would have been, but they were still getting bombed. There's pictures you can see of them just cowering against the beaches, hoping that the bomb didn't hit them that did come, while they waited their turn to rout to these boats. For 9 days, the fortuitous weather continued, and the evacuation was completed, aided by calm seas and a fog which obscured them from the air attacks. A total of 338,226 soldiers were rescued from the beaches by a fleet of about 700 boats, consisting of large destroyers, but down to small fishing boats, pleasure boats, and even lifeboats. Anything that would float was being used to get those people off the shores. Admiral Ramsey, the mastermind of the operation, later reported, "It must be fully realized that a wind of any strength in the northern sector between the southwest and the northeast would have made beach evacuation impossible. At no time did that happen." So the day after the evacuation ended, the weather shifted. The winds rose, causing large breakers to be seen crashing onto the now cleared beaches of Dunkirk. British Prime Minister Winston Churchill referred to the outcome as a miracle of deliverance. There were services of thanksgiving in churches throughout the land, and many soldiers told of spiritual experiences that they had had during the evacuation, which made them believe that God had intervened on Britain's side for a reason. It's an amazing story. It doesn't matter if God was the one controlling the weather for those 9 days. He possibly could have been, but even if it was just a strange storm that happened to settle over that area for 9 days and suddenly ended when they got out, but there's no doubt that the weather made an enormous impact on that battle and possibly the entire war. So I don't know if God controls the weather today or not, but I know that he has in the past. The story of the Dunkirk evacuation reminds me a lot of when God did control the weather, one specific time when he did. After Pharaoh had let the Israelites go following the plagues, and they're making their way to the Promised Land, and they're up against the Red Sea, and Pharaoh had changed his mind and started coming after them again, and the Israelites could see him, and they were afraid and scared and wondering why they even left Egypt in the first place. God took control of the weather and helped them out. Exodus chapter 14 says, "And an angel of the Lord who went before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud went before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp and the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was a cloud and darkness to no one, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near the other all that night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left." So, kind of similar. He had that fog kind of come in, or the clouds come in, to kind of separate the two camps, allowing the Israelites time to escape. But there's a lot of other examples of when God took control of the weather to help his people or to hinder those who were against him. I'm just going to go through some of these real quick. You don't need to turn there. Genesis chapter 6, of course, is the story of the flood. No explanation needed there. He obviously took control of the weather there. In Joshua chapter 10, Joshua and the Israelites are fighting at Gibeon. This is just before Joshua prayed to God to extend the day, have the sun stand still. It says in Joshua chapter 10, verse 11, "And it happened as they fled before Israel and were on the descent of Beth Horon, that the Lord cast down large hailstones from heaven on them as far as Azekah, and they died. There were more who died from the hailstones than the children of Israel killed with the sword." So more people died by the hailstones from God than the Israelites killed with the sword. And then, of course, the story of Jonah. Jonah was told by God to go to Nineveh. He was afraid to go and preach there and didn't want to, ran away on a ship. And God, of course, controlled the wind that day as well. Jonah chapter 1, verses 4, starting verse 4. "But the Lord sent out a great wind on the sea, and there was a mighty tempest on the sea, so that the ship was about to be broken up. Then the mariners were afraid, and every man cried out to his God, and threw the cargo that was in the ship into the sea to lighten the load. But Jonah had gone into the lowest parts of the ship, had lain down, and was fast asleep." And of course, once he gets woken up, and they figure out what's going on, and he tells them to throw him overboard. In Jonah 1:15, it says, "So they picked up Jonah and threw him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging." So God has controlled the weather in the past. He still could today. I definitely wouldn't put that past him. He definitely could. Whether or not he does, I don't know. The weather we have today is because of his design, though. He designed it to work the way it does. But weather can have a big impact on our lives, whether it's controlled by God or not. Many people think of thunderstorms as being scary and harmful, and they certainly can be with the rain, heavy rains and hail and tornadoes. But there's also a positive impact for these thunderstorms as well. If we go too long without rain, we have droughts. So thunderstorms provide water. Thunderstorms can act as an air conditioner. They can cool off the air. Without thunderstorms, the heat in the atmosphere would continue to increase and eventually become uncomfortable. Just remember last week how hot it was. And then we got the thunderstorm Thursday night, and it's cooled off quite a bit. In fact, we had our windows open most of the day yesterday, which was unheard of for me in June. But it definitely cooled it off. A thunderstorm can help clean the air by removing pollution from the atmosphere. The lightning from thunderstorms, they can help change the nitrogen in the atmosphere to nitrates, which then fertilize the soil and allow plants to grow. And the lightning also produces ozone, obviously a vital gas in our atmosphere, to help shield the planet from ultraviolet sunlight. So again, this was all God's design, this type of weather. And it has a huge impact on us, whether or not he's controlling it directly or not. When the Israelites moved into the Promised Land, I'll be referring it to either Canaan or Palestine throughout the rest here, just because that's what my references called it. But it had its own kind of weather, and it was a little different from where they came from in Egypt. And God even mentions that, and we'll get to that. But this area of Palestine and Israel today, it's not a very big area. It's a really small area. It's about the size of New Jersey. But it's a really, even for being that small, it has a lot of diverse weather. Some parts can get a lot of rain. Some can get hardly any. The wind can either bring coolness from the Mediterranean Sea or heat from the desert. Like I said, God even spoke to Moses about the benefits of the weather in this area compared to what they had in Egypt. This is in Deuteronomy chapter 11. I'll be reading here for a little bit, so if you want to turn there, you can. Deuteronomy chapter 11. Beginning in verse 10. "For the land which you go to possess is not like the land of Egypt from which you have come, where you sowed your seed and watered it by foot as a vegetable garden. But the land which you cross over to possess is a land of hills and valleys, which drinks water from the rain of heaven, a land for which your God, the Lord your God, cares. And the eyes of the Lord your God are always on it, from the beginning of the year to the very end of the year. So God said that this land was not like the land of Egypt. From what I was reading in Egypt, in order to get water for their crops, they mainly use irrigation. They get water from the Nile River over to their crops in some way. So it's a lot different than getting the rainfall where they're going to now. So this new land, the promised land, says that God cares for it, not just for the people, he cares for the land as well. And he told Moses that he would control the seasons, or at least there would be seasons now, and he would provide rain for his people. My Bible had a little note here. So I'll be reading several different little notes, but there was a note here about the rainfall in this area. The pattern of rainfall dictated the way a season would develop. Steady rainfall coming at critical times produced better crops than heavy, intermittent rainfall. A farmer in Palestine had to contend with a five-month rainless summer, so from May to October. If the following autumn rains were sporadic, the results could be disastrous. 3 months without rain during autumn would destroy most crops. The early rains were the first autumn showers, and the latter rains were the last spring showers. From what I would gather, I think their crop rotation is a little different than us. We usually go spring to autumn. I think they go autumn to spring, from what I was gathering. So the early rains are the ones in the autumn, latter rains are the spring. And then between these were the rains of January. For the early rains, again the ones in autumn, prepared the soil for the seed, and the latter rains in the spring filled out the crops for harvest. The amount of rain received in different locations varied greatly. For example, in modern Palestine, so today, Jericho receives about 5.5 inches of rainfall per year, while the areas in Upper Galilee have gotten 47 inches per year. So again, that's a huge difference for such a small little country. So that gives you an idea of kind of about what the rainfall patterns were in this area that the Israelites are moving into. Continuing in Deuteronomy chapter 11, God continues to tell Moses about the weather. And this section is going to talk about the early and the latter rains as well that we just discussed. Again, picking up in verse 13 of chapter 11. And it shall be that if you earnestly obey my commandments, which I command you today, to love the Lord your God and serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, then I will give you the rain for your land in its season, the early rain and the latter rain, that you may gather in your grain, your new wine, and your oil. And I will send grass in your fields for your livestock, that you may eat and be filled. Take heed to yourselves, lest your heart be deceived, and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them, lest the Lord's anger be aroused against you, and he shut up the heavens, so that there be no rain, and the land yield no produce, and you perish quickly from the good land which the Lord is giving you. So again, God is saying that he is going to give them the rains of the seasons. He's going to give them the early rain to help the growth of the seed, and then the latter rains in the spring to fill out the crops for the harvest. Again, but God had a warning to them. God warned them that if they were to turn away, if they were to start serving other gods, then his anger would be aroused against them, and then he would withhold this rain. And the land would not produce anything because there'd be no grass for the cattle, there'd be no crops for the rich regular crops, and that they would die. The people would die. Even though they'd been given a good land, they would die because they didn't get the rain in order to help them out. God stayed true to his word, too. I'm not going to go to it, but there's an example in 1 Kings chapter 17 where Elijah is telling King Ahab that there wouldn't be any rain or dew for the next few years because Ahab had allowed God's people to turn to Baal and believe that this false god then controlled the dew and the rain. So God did withhold the rain and the dew from them. So he would do that. So how is the rain in your Christian life? How is the rain in your Christian life? We read here about how the rain was in Palestine and Israel, and an early rain and a latter rain. How is the rain in your Christian life? Are you getting the early rain and the latter rain? Are you being encouraged to sprout and send out new growth? Are you being encouraged to grow spiritually, either by the lessons you hear or the study on your own? Because that's the early rain that encourages growth. If you need this rain, if you're needing this early rain, if you're not getting this early rain to help that growth, you need to find out why. Are we sheltered from the rain? Are we blocking it off? Are we not absorbing this early rain in our lives? Are we not absorbing the lessons we hear? Are we hearing the lessons but not taking them into our lives in order to improve? Do we need more rain? Are we just needing more input? Are we needing to go to weekend meetings or week-long meetings and absorb some more of this rain in our lives to help us help encourage us to grow? Or maybe you need to water yourself by studying God's Word at home. A lot of ways in order to get this early rain, this rain that would have come in the autumn to encourage new growth. But this rain is essential for growth. And then there's the latter rain. If you're beginning the latter rain, the rain in the spring to help bring the crops to maturity. We can't stay as seedlings all our lives, as a small little seed hoping to grow, getting ready to grow. We do need to develop. The writer of the book of Hebrews writes in chapter 5, verse 12, "For though by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again the first principles of the oracles of God. And you have come to need milk and not solid food. For everyone who partakes only of milk is unskilled in the word of righteousness, for he is a babe. But solid food belongs to those who are of full age, that is, those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil." These people should have grown enough spiritually by this time that they should have been teachers of their own, the writer says, but they were still needing milk themselves. They were still babes. They had not grown enough. They weren't getting that latter rain to help bring them to harvest. They had not grown enough. So we need to look at our lives as well and see if, make sure we're sprouting for one thing, but also make sure we're still growing. Make sure we're still not just seeds. We need to be growing. Another type of weather that was common in Palestine is the wind. And my Bible had a note on this as well. The wind is both a boon and a bane, both good and bad, to Palestine. The hot climate is eased by cool Mediterranean winds during the day. Chill evenings provide a welcome change from the day's heat in desert and hill country. The moisture-laden sea winds combine with cool air at night to give Palestine its vital dew. A southeasterly wind marks the change of seasons in Palestine from spring to summer and from summer to fall. Jeremiah chapter 4, verse 11 mentions a dry wind of the desolate heights that blows in the wilderness. This dry wind, loaded with dust, makes the people very uncomfortable. The Bible's east wind, which is in Jeremiah 18 and 17, maybe what the Arabs call Khamsin. This wind leaves people irritable and feeling like doing nothing because of the oppressive heat. And it says that Jonah may have experienced this as well in Jonah chapter 4:8, which we're going to discuss here as well. But would you rather have a nice, cool, moist wind from the Mediterranean blowing over you, or a dusty, hot wind blowing in from the desert? You'll need to answer that. Most people would pick the cool wind, especially in a place where they were at, where it was hot, like a lot. So you'd want that cool air even more so. But this east wind that it talks about, it says that this east wind was loaded with dust. So not only was this a hot wind coming in, it was a dusty wind. It would have this dust blowing through the air. So you'd have to keep it out of your eyes, out of your mouth, get over your clothes. Like I said there, this dry wind made people very uncomfortable. And if that's what it was like, I can definitely see why. But Jonah did have this east wind blow upon him from God. This is in Jonah chapter 4. But again, just to kind of recap what's going on with Jonah. Remember chapter 1, he was thrown overboard. Chapter 2, he's in the big fish, prays to God, and gets God's forgiveness. Chapter 3, Jonah's speaking to the people of Nineveh, like he was supposed to from the beginning, and they actually turn from their evil ways and are turning towards God, which is a good thing. Chapter 4 begins oddly, though. For some reason, Jonah's upset. Jonah's upset about Nineveh's repentance. He is angry that Nineveh repented and that God is sparing them. Whatever reason he has to be mad, whether he thought that they needed God's punishment, that they needed to be judged no matter what, whatever the case is, Jonah was mad about it. And he goes outside the city and he makes a little shelter for himself. And God, being generous, makes this plant to grow up, this little vine to grow up, and gives Jonah some shade to shade out the sun a little bit. And Jonah really liked that plant. Then we'll pick up. So Jonah chapter 4 through 11. But at dawn the next day, God provided a worm which chewed the vine so that it withered. So he lost his plant. Then the sun rose. God provided a scorching east wind. And the sun blazed on Jonah's head so that he grew faint. He wanted to die and said, it would be better for me to die than to live. I'm sorry, this is the new International Version. I like the wording of this one better. Verse 9, But God said to Jonah, "Do you have a right to be angry about the vine?" "I do," he said. "I am angry enough to die." But the Lord said, "You have been concerned about this vine, though you did not tend it or make it grow. It sprang up overnight and died overnight. But Nineveh has more than 120,000 people who cannot tell their right hand from their left, and many cattle as well. Should I not be concerned about that great city?" So Jonah was angry with God when he didn't destroy Nineveh, just like Jonah wanted. And then he was also angry when God destroyed this little plant. That Jonah didn't plant this plant. He didn't put the seed in. He didn't help it grow. It just grew up overnight, and then it died overnight. But Jonah is as mad about this plant dying as he is about God not punishing the people of Nineveh. He seemingly cared for this plant more than he cared for the people of Nineveh. Jonah selfishly wanted his way, no matter the outcome. He was putting his cares and desires possibly before the people of Nineveh. And he didn't understand why God would be doing what he was doing. We can often want to get our own way in our Christian lives as well. There might be something that we want to do in our Christian lives that we shouldn't be doing, but we want to do it. And we try to find a way to convince ourselves that we know better than God, that what we're doing really isn't that bad, that we can do it, and we can make excuses for ourselves in order to help convince ourselves that it's something okay to do. That's kind of like what Jonah was doing in a way there. And this east wind that then blew in Jonah's face, it would help him understand that he was wrong. And maybe if we find ourselves doing that, maybe we can have this east wind blowing in our lives as well. Sometimes we can, if we're doing this, we can have this uncomfortable feeling. Remember, that east wind was uncomfortable because it had all that dust. Now we're not going to get dust in our eyes when we're doing something wrong. But deep down in the pit of our stomach, if we're doing something we shouldn't do and we know it and we're making those excuses, we can maybe get that little sick feeling. We can start getting a little uncomfortable. Maybe that's that east wind blowing in our lives, telling us that our priorities are wrong. we're putting the plant before the city. And something needs to change. So I mentioned earlier about the areas of Palestine, Israel, how they received different amounts of rain. But rainfall, it was the main source of moisture, but it wasn't the only source, and I mentioned it in one of the little notes. But the final weather, the final type of weather that I want to look at this evening is from another note. Palestine's rainfall is directly related to the latitude and elevation of the land. And I've kind of gotten into this. The mountainous regions in northern Galilee received the most rain, on average 24 to 36 inches. And there's that one report of 47, so it can go even higher. But while the southern plains get very little, 4 to 8 inches, an estimated 60 to 70% of the precipitation is lost through evaporation because of the land's high temperatures and low humidity. So what rain they do get, it evaporates really quick. Only 10 to 25% is absorbed for agricultural purposes. So the dew that falls approximately 250 nights of the year is essential. Some vegetation depends entirely on the dew's moisture. It's an exhilarating experience to wake up in the Negev desert on a summer morning and see a thick fog. That's not quite the end of that little note. I'll finish the rest here in a bit. But that would be interesting, to go into a desert and then wake up in the morning and you do see the fog over the desert, because normally deserts are all dry, but due to their location, they would have this moisture come over this desert due to the fog, or the dew that's coming in. And this weather pattern, it's the dew is mentioned as well, as far as its impact on the land and the impact on the people, and it's related to. If you want to turn to the book of Hosea, well, you don't have to if you don't want to, but I'll be mentioning Hosea here in just a minute, a scripture from it. But in the book of Hosea, that book is mainly a big metaphor of how unfaithful Israel was to God, and compared it to an adulterous wife, a wife that was constantly being unfaithful to Hosea. And even though his wife was unfaithful, Hosea continued to love her, just as God continued to love Israel. In the sixth chapter of Hosea, God is talking about the impenitence, my Bible called it, or the people having no regret for their sins, not being penitent, but they're not regretting their sins at all. Specifically, the two nations of Israel, it's going to mention, because at this time they were split into two nations. They had two kings. So this is in Hosea chapter 6, verse 4. It says, "O Ephraim, what shall I do with you? O Judah, what shall I do to you? For your faithfulness is like a morning cloud, and like the early dew, it goes away. What shall I do with you? Your faithfulness is like a morning cloud." And that faithfulness can also be translated to kindness towards God or love towards God. So your love is like a morning cloud. Like the early dew, it goes away. So the last message, or the last line in my note that I was reading, it says, "Yet the dew evaporates quickly, Yet the dew evaporates quickly, and it became proverbial to compare Israel's faithlessness to a morning cloud, that early dew that goes away." So any apparent faithfulness that Hosea's generation might have had, it was short-lived, apparently. It was short-lived, and it disappeared as quickly as that morning dew would disappear as the morning drew on and the heat came up. So it didn't last long. Their faithfulness, their kindness towards God, their love towards God did not stay long. Are you like a morning dew? Are we like a morning dew? Does our faith, does our kindness, does our love towards God remain with us throughout the entire day? Do we wake up refreshed, ready to go in the morning, and then as the day goes on and we get more tired and things start happening at work or school or whatever, and we feel that dew lifting, evaporating, and we start losing that faithfulness and that love. I would hope not, but I think sometimes it can. We can feel strong for a while, especially here, like Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. We can get refreshed here, and then when we leave, it can eventually, we're not as strong, it doesn't feel like sometimes. We feel differently, like that, like a dew is evaporating almost. And the same thing can be felt after meetings. Maybe not our meeting, because we're so busy doing other stuff, but other meetings. If you go to a meeting where you can just listen and absorb everything, you feel powerful when you come back. And then eventually that feeling goes away. Something is changing. That dew could be lifting. You're not going to keep that the entire time, no matter what. But you need to make sure that it's not leaving you entirely. You need to keep that love and that faithfulness. We need to keep that dew in our lives as long as we can. Winston Churchill called the Dunkirk evacuation a miracle of deliverance. Those 330,000 men, didn't stand much of a chance of being delivered from the Germans. They were stuck. If they had just stayed on the beaches, they would have been killed or captured. They had no hope to return home. But whether by God's control or not, they were given an opportunity to escape from that beach and return home. On our own, we don't stand a chance of going to heaven. We have sin in our lives, and we're stranded on that beach with no hope of escape, no hope of deliverance. But God was willing to give us a chance of deliverance. He was willing to give us deliverance, not just a chance. But it isn't a miracle of deliverance. It was a gift of deliverance. God gave us His only Son, Jesus Christ, to take our place on that beach. He sacrificed Himself so that we could be rescued. We could be picked up from one of those boats and delivered to safety, delivered from our sins. So how's your weather this evening? How's your spiritual weather this evening? Are you lacking rain? Are you too dry? Are you needing the rain of encouragement or the latter rain of growth? Is there a hot and dusty east wind blowing on you, telling you there's something wrong, that you're not doing something quite right? There's an uncomfortable feeling. That's something you need to change. Or is your morning dew evaporating? Are you keeping your faith and your trust, your kindness and your love towards God all day long? Or does it only last until something goes wrong and then it evaporates? So how's your weather? If you need help with your spiritual weather this evening, we would love to help you, and so would God. God can actually control the weather if He wants to. He has done in the past. He can help control our spiritual weather as well. So if we need Him, if you need Him in your life to help Him do that, or if you need our help, you're invited to come forward as we stand and sing.